Thank you. getting as many clues as the national consumer tribunal and to mediate the in terms of where these disputes might occur. In terms of clause 5, which comes to the registration of payment distribution agents, tomorrow the payment distribution agents association will actually be presenting the submission, and they'll cover this in more detail in terms of what's happening on the ground at the moment, as well as their proposal. However, other stakeholders have raised concerns in terms of having a clear definition of role and obligation duties and criteria for registration of EDAs established. This is currently broadly alluded to in the role, but there aren't any specific details on that at this stage. A number of people have raised concerns that PDA should fall under the National Payment System to reduce costs on consumers. However, as we'll hear tomorrow, apparently PDAs are currently required to do this under the service level agreement with the NCR. Then consumers, it is thought that consumers should have a choice on whether or not they use the PDA and it shouldn't be mandatory, as well as providing debt counselors the opportunity to also provide a service, given certain strict requirements. And then one of the concerns around PDAs was the fact that it's been alleged that certain consumers have not failed to pay because the PDA doesn't fulfill the obligation to that consumer by paying either on time or to the right service provider. So they're raising concerns that consumers should be protected, but when in situations where PDA may default, and there may be backlash from that protected service provider. Then furthermore, there was a concern that PDAs aren't fully incorporated throughout jurisdiction. There is one current amendment related to this, and it's related to Section 56, where they refer to them having to be not be an unregistered involvement. But in terms of other sections of Chapter 3, this is not covered at all. In terms of Clause 8, there was a large concern around the minister giving powers to prescribe a code of conduct or guidelines. The impression that I have gotten from the DGI stage is that the intention is to move away from self-regulation of service providers, especially in terms of affordability assessments. And therefore, the intention may be to actually drop regulations and not guidelines. But currently, the bill proposes still that the guidelines should be mandatory, which is not actually possible. If the DS opportunity decides to move away from guidelines and specifically regulate affordability assessment measures, then we need to actually amend certain other sections of that of the NCA at the moment, which allow for in Section 82, it actually allows for first providers to have their own evaluative measures, which are at their discretion. So therefore, we need to actually amend that the minister may prescribe regulations in this regard, as well as enforce this by expecting to enforce the provider to actually do so. In terms of clause 12, there were some concerns on issuing of clearing certificates. Currently, the debt counselors are provided with the proposal is that the debt counselors are given 7 business days to determine whether or not a clearance certificate should be issued. Debt counselors felt that this is too short and it should possibly be 10 business days so that one can also determine that consumer has actually paid everything up to date at that stage to also allow for clearance of payments in the system. And also need to assess whether or not they can afford to either if they haven't paid all the all obligations up to date according to the arrangement, but they can actually afford to pay at the original installments that they have rather than at the rearrangement agreement. And the other concern was in terms of long-term debt, specifically mortgages. There was concern raised that if one applies to the first rule as is, you know, the situation where if you thought that you would not outstanding at the due range of 50 days, you wouldn't be able to actually access any new debt because you couldn't get clearance certificate. So the proposal is that the clearance certificate issued if you either have paid up all your obligations or you are out of default with all events that your arrears are paid up to date and you can afford to pay the original installments of all your outstanding agreements. In terms of clause 30, we have seen quite a number of comments in terms of automatic removal of credit information. The general concern is the impact that it will have on credit providers' ability to adequately complete their assessment requirement and also to determine whether or not they are involved in the spending or not. The general concern is that at this stage, payment profiles should remain. However, in certain cases, for instance, we made an example where there's just been a judgment and you paid up 2 years ago, but your payment profile only comes 2 years. So you could have a complete gap and just like if your credit information was in there, maybe an instance where maybe that you never had credit, and that added information is also removed. So certain consumers may be at risk. And in clause 14, refers to the once of removal of adverse credit information. It's listed there as empty mainly because that was the term used by most stakeholders, but it's actually the removal of adverse credit information as well as the auditing of credit information. Now, so similar to clause 13, the argument of the impact will have a credit provider to be able to do the affordability assessment. And then so 15 relates back to the concern in terms of the issue of the minister providing guidelines in terms of affordability assistance versus regulations. So that would be particularly needs to be amended to refer to regulations specifically and not guidelines. So 17 focuses on applications. Okay, clause 16 relates to the declaration of regulatory agreement. So most of the stakeholders are not of the view that the tribunal should be given this power. They feel that they do not have the sufficient legal expertise and all the capacity to declare a regulatory agreement. Clause 17, the application for debt review. As the core issue appears to be around the fact that an application for debt review would be lodged, not lodged, would be utilized for a debt review with the debt counselor. Being a credit provider has 60 days once you've applied to refuse this or to ask for his credit agreement to be terminated from the process. So many of the stakeholders feel that currently, if a debt counselor were to lodge that application in court before the 60 days are up, this could lead to a situation where a credit provider cannot terminate and has, in a sense, stuck potential consumer who doesn't want to pay. So in the case where consumers stop paying what they, or even the rearranged agreement, they say nothing to the credit provider, and it's in court, and the court person is paid, that they have no recourse. So many of our credit providers wanting some certainty that if a consumer doesn't continue paying their installment, that they can have some redress and actually enforce their rights. In terms of clause 18, this relates to unequal credit agreements. They either feeling that the purpose of section 89.5, the first one, should be reconsidered. There should be a situation where a court considers whether or not the credit agreement was provided. Whether the credit provided was desirable, as well as not leading to a situation where you just have a blank situation where all credit agreements are being considered void and you actually need to get probation property in an arbitrary manner. So I think that the area where this would be more applicable would be where A credit provider is even interested but may not consider himself a credit provider. For instance, if you or I decide to lend somebody a special amount of money on a bank account, but it's not a business to lend the credit, then being forced to not have any useful credit that person uses. Two new subsections in terms of the registration and accreditation of alternative dispute resolution agents, as well as the deregistration of those agents. Members of the public felt that that we need to limit the role of an ADR agent to be focused on the act and the scope of the act. And possibly that the NGO should not register them, but rather create a list of appropriate ADR agents can assist consumers and how they can access these. And then in terms of this deregistration, there was a few proposals that the minister should describe guidelines for the condition of registration of ADR agents, accreditation criteria, and ADR fees payable by the consumer, so there could be a maximum fee. And that the ADR agent's condition of registration, the accreditation criteria should be aligned and not in conflict with any other license that they may hold with another regulatory authority. So if we wanted to deregister them on the side, that there would be some kind of alliance with the other process. And then this is specific by the grant for deregistration. There were a number of other concerns that were raised which do not fall directly within the scope of the bill or potentially in the scope of the Act. These related to high interest rates and other credit charges, the impact of the attachment orders, which is outside the scope of the Act, debt collectors and how much they charge and how their practices work, which is also going to fall outside the scope of the Act. The in-loop rule. Accessibility of debt review process, in terms of, it was thought that the debt review process only assists a few consumers because the cost is currently too high. And you have to pay an upfront cost and then also for fees. In terms of consent orders, ensuring payments of debt review consent orders finalized, withdrawal, having mechanisms to withdraw from the debt review process, and then housing finance. I'll just briefly touch on the interest rates and other credit charges. There was a big concern in terms of the interest rates and charges that are being charged by credit providers as well, including fixed-life insurance, increasing travel and fuel benefits. And this often leads to defaults if the rate of cost of the credit substantially. So the other proposal was that one should possibly consider lowering an interest rate as a possibility, which is not currently a possibility, an explicit possibility. And then simplifying our prescribed interest rates under maximum rates that we currently have. Frankly, it's the formula for most of different types of credit agreements, except for one or two where there's a specific case today. Again, it was a concern that currently the structure of our interest reduces the incentive to provide secured loans relative to other kinds of credit. So there was a tendency for credit providers to want to now move more to unsecured loans rather than secured forms of credit. And so we should consider reducing the level of installation interest limits, especially when the start people rate. And then in terms of accessibility of the debt review process, this was the main concern of having accessible alternative dispute resolutions and or voluntary debt mediation rather than only having debt review processes, particularly for low income consumers. Yeah. those are the key points which Stengel has raised thus far.
Thank you, Ms. Henning. Let me just quickly check if there is anyone who might be misrepresented by this table. Welcome, Mr. Stengel.
There's quite a number of areas that civil laws can create. There's guidelines versus regulations. What are we really saying? If we could go back to that particular area of guidelines and regulations, where the minister should give guidelines, and it looks like there's a proposal that says no guidelines must be included in the regulations instead of the minister's power. I'm not very clear to what we are saying. Maybe I'll see some more clarity of a clearer position of where we are dealing. Are we saying guidelines must be part of the regulation? Are we saying the minister must be giving power to discuss code of conduct or the guidelines? We must be clear what we are saying. Who is saying it should be part of the regulation? And who is saying it should be the power of the minister to develop that code of conduct? What do we say to colleagues in that vision? The issue of mortgage versus the certificate and versus the second bond. See, the current situation provides that when you have paid up to a particular amount of your bond, even though you have not completed paying that bond, you can be able to apply the bank for a second bond. And what we are saying now is that if the federal has paid, what was a creation of adverse information against him or her, that information, that other information must be removed so that it can qualify for the aid. And I'm seeing a version here that says, if we move that way, it will mean that the option of the second bond must wait until the second has fully paid the third bond. That's what it means up to now. So then it will then deprive the consumer who can go into the second bond until the first time he has a certificate of having been a good payer, and all other information against him is not followed. So we need to clarify what we need to say. My interpretation has been, this matter of adverse information is only in relation to where a person has defaulted, to the extent that there is adverse information. And as was explained earlier, to us, adverse information would mean information, a record that would be saying you are the bad payer, a record that would refer you to blacklisting, a record that would actually make it impossible for the next credit provider to can give you credit. But that is not the friendly mean that it is working against the other one. And it is when that other information gets removed, when it doesn't escape, then the certificate can be issued. But not that every time a person has a credit, on completion of that credit, that person must get a certificate. I'm not very sure of what we are saying there. Clause 13, can we take a look at clause 13? Talks about the benefits that the risk is. And that's chapter.
I'd like us to raise issues that are not clear in terms of the records. They are in, or issues that might not have been presented correctly by the Senate. I want to say this so that we don't raise issues that we as a committee are delivering on after all these things and issues that we must clear between ourselves and the department. Because she can't answer those questions. I would like us to stick to that if there's anything that we can get from the report that she's given.
Misrepresentation of the true facts, that's what he said. If the presentation does not say a true picture of what he as a truth was spread.
That's what I want to do.
Okay. So that
we correct a record. The rest is for us to consider.
Alright, I'm not there yet.
Okay. Yeah.
I just want to clarify, in terms of the guidelines and regulations, currently a guideline is not binding, but it cannot be forced upon a specified. So a regulation can be. So we need the department to specify, do they want self-regulation, which means guidelines are appropriate, it's not binding, but they give a sort of a scope of what the expertise cover versus a regulation of something you must do, which then moves away from self-regulation and it's the end of the NCR. And then in terms of the clearance certificate, that's specifically if you've been under the review. So it doesn't involve something that's just imported. It's something that's actually applied for purposes of this view, has entered it, and is basically feels they're completing it. So they should either finish the review process and get a clearance certificate where they are able to enter the market in, or where they feel the situation's improved substantially so they don't need to bring the review any longer. That's when you issue that clearance.
All right. It seems we're done with this part of the agenda. Thank you very much. Can we take all further inputs from MFSA followed by Deb? If it requires to use
Jane, I'm comfortable to speak from here.
Thank you.
to respond to some of the questions which we received last week, as well as some of the matters which have been raised during the proceedings earlier this week. I am going to talk to roughly three matters, and they do relate. In terms of the submission which came in earlier this week, we made a heading which said the supply of credit short-term in the unsecured market. And this really goes back to some of the discussion we had around the suppliers of credit in the market, and also some specific questions about unions and employers in the market. I thought I would use the opportunity to go slightly broad to create the full picture, and would be quite happy if Chair to take questions as comes. I will also be picking up on the issue of the SASSA situation. Mention was made by the honourable members of people at ATMs with briefcases full of SASSA cards. I would like to respond to that. And then I would also particularly like to pick up on the issues around the race and fees and the sustainability of businesses. If that is in order, Chair, to my understanding of the questions. I think in being part of this discussion, and I need to say that it's been a good experience for the sector to be here, and we do appreciate the engagement. I would like to say it's probably long overdue, and I hope we're setting a trend for the future, because we are dealing with some really concrete matters, and these matters we do appreciate touches the lives of most South Africans. I also need to put on record that reckless lending is not in the interest of any of the stakeholders who have a long-term vision for their businesses and who want to sustain their businesses. I think there's sometimes a perception that by being reckless, you are actually doing something that is worth your while. Current headlines in newspapers will show, and does show, that the market can punish you very hard if you do not act responsibly. So I wish to put that on record. In terms of the supply side of credit in South Africa, I think we need to first of all say that it's a hugely competitive environment, and that it is also an evolving environment, and things are changing as we speak for many reasons. There seems to be also a need to clarify the distinction between credit providers, how they collect their money, and what are the products they're putting into the market. The first definition, which needs to be clear, we need to be clear on, is that of a short-term loan. A short-term loan is a loan in which the term does not exceed 6 months, and the capital amount cannot exceed 8,000 rand. There are specific rules around how the price of that product is determined, which you can find in the Act. Secondly, we have a market of unsecured loan. Now, a short-term loan is unsecured in the sense that there is no underlying assets, and you cannot go and collect the person's car, his house, or whatever needs to be unsecured. Then we have a category of loan which is unsecured. The unsecured loan has no cap in terms of term, and it has no cap in terms of the capital amount. And the growth we've seen in the unsecured market, which for the last 18 months and longer have caused many alarms to go off, has been around that particular product. And in order to play in that market, you need to be sure that you do have the capital. So smaller guys find it extremely difficult to play in that market, and the growth, as I showed in the presentation last week, in the unsecured market originates from that specific product. And we believe, and with respect, Chairman, I was part of the previous rounds of discussions and deliberations from where we sit at Microfinance South Africa, which represents a wide spectrum of lenders from big to small. If we could do it over, we would have kept the size of an unsecured loan and term. So that the practices which has come forward and it's been displayed in the last couple of years would not have been able to take place, and I believe the market would have been totally different filing rights with regards to this market. There is a rife market in what we call machinishas, loan sharks, bucky lenders, scoppers. I have been to a Sasa payout point where more than 50 guys have been thrown out to me. That is over and above guys selling illegal insurance based on the bank book. That market is there, and that is the default market for people at the low end of the market. If that need, if their need for credit doesn't get satisfied, that we adjust. And in one of our engagement sessions around amnesty, people were saying to us, DTI officials were saying to us, in a local environment, if a guy needs 500 rand on a Sunday morning, he wants to be able to go to the local guy and get the 500 rand. That market is there, and it's well established. We also have in the market the banks, the four big banks is in this market, the two smaller banks, which you all know is in this market, and then we have a host of registered credit providers. There is also, unfortunately, a grouping of larger companies which operate under the radar. You will not see them at top floor level, but they are in most small towns, and they play by their own rules. There's no formality, there's no affordability, and certainly there is no tax of being paid, and the consequences of not paying is normally bad. Which then takes me into the comments around another market, and that is the market of employers and trade unions who do supply credit. Let me say from the outset, there are unions and employers who provide credit products which are registered and it's fully compliant with all requirements and then as a service to their employees. The less formal the company and the smaller the company goes and certain sectors, we also find informal credit, and the crux is that credit is collected via a payroll deduction. The payroll deduction puts the provider of credit in a position where he or she can collect on a preferential basis. And we do take the position that a preferential deduction can be underlined. I'm not saying it is or was, because there are good products in this market, can be the underlying cause of excess credit. And unless there is proper supervision over that space, you are correct. Now, in the real world of collections, people collect in one of three ways. One is, payment is made in cash. Second one is, you use an actual payment system and you use a debit order system. Oversight over the payment system via the South African Reserve Bank and the Payments Association of South Africa is rigorous. And you are constantly being reviewed and you need to play by the rules, including dealing with issues of preferential deductions. When you move into the payroll deduction phase, there is debate as to who and what has oversight. Despite that, a loan being made which is collected via payroll deduction should still meet all the other criteria of the National Credit Act, including but not limited to that a credit provider must be registered, that the pot must be done, affordability assessment must be done, and the consumer, in many cases in the union member or the employee, enjoys all the rights and protection which you have in terms of the national. So the great area around payroll deductions probably also relates to the debates and discussions around emolument attachment rules. Because the closer you can be to the point of the salary, the better your chances are of collection. And the abusive practices in the EAO space, and we must not throw the child out with hardwood, the abusive practices in the space of EAOs is to be as close as possible to the source of income. And the reasons and the motivations for that may be. So Mr. Chairman, honourable members, the supply side and the product variation and the definition in terms of short-term and unsecured loans needs to be fully understood when we are in deliberations. I want to bring two issues onto the table which may require some further clarity. The one is the concept of an ATM loan. An ATM loan is provided to a person who goes to the ATM. The bank has evaluated that person and they say to him, you can apply. The transaction happens at the ATM. I am sure it has fulfilled the needs of many consumers, but the process is very different from walking into my member's office where you have to sit through affordability, your score is run, your credentials are checked, your employment is verified. It's a totally different process. And that's very, very easy credit. And we think that is problematic. The next concept I would like to touch on, Jay, is that of the concept of floating around of a payday lender. I am unsure what we say when we use the concept of a payday lender. A payday lender. It is a concept that comes from the United States. I have engaged with the people in that country. And I'm not sure why it has been introduced. And it seems to me that it has normally been used in a derogatory way. And I think we need to be very clear that in South Africa we have credit providers, and if you are registered with the NCR, you pay the taxes, you're part of the fraternity. If you are not registered and you make yourself guilty of abusive practices, calling what you like. And I think it's important that we deal with other issues. I want to just touch on the issue around SASSA. I think we're all aware in this room about the matters playing out around this particular situation. There will be activities at the Constitutional Court next week which deals with the way the tender has been allocated. And that situation demonstrates a couple of important issues to us. One example of the briefcase with the cars, it is happening, and it's illegal. And we believe this problem should be tackled in a very aggressive way. We also have evidence of beneficiaries who say that we are entitled to have credit. I think what is missing at this stage is, one, there's a need to harmonize the activities between the various departments and agencies. That would include issues around competition, compliance, marketing, and in very specifically, the rules around reckless lending. At this stage, the view is that the SASSA card is a full bank card. It's fully enabled to be used in the banking system, and therefore the oversight over that card is also in the space of the South African Reserve Bank. And this matter has not been fully cleared out, and there are abuses, and we're certainly not in the favor of those abuses, and I think it needs very serious attention. Then, finally, Chair, I would like to move on to the issue of rates and fees. Even in the previous summary of Ms. Henning, the comment was made about exorbitant rates. I think the plea from our side is the following. Let us get around the table and let us scientifically determine the cost of doing business, especially in the lower end of the market, and especially in delivering smaller loans. Let us agree on what needs to be considered, and let's be transparent about that, and let us get to a point where a reasonable businessman, and we're not pleading for protection of the weakest of the weak and the people who are not competent, and we are not pleading for social protection in any way, but let us get to a point where in a transparent fashion the workings behind determining the fees and the rates is out there. We have been because credit providers are being forced to sell bigger products in order to keep their businesses afloat so that they can reach break even. And I have surprised other comparisons which shows the cost behind these businesses and what do you need to do to just stay in play. And clearly, if you are in competing on a level of sale, you are competing with banks, and the consequence of that would be, and we have seen it, people going out of business. The sad side is, and I did mention last week, and the chair was corrected me and warned me, and I take the warning with great respect. The reality is, there are people moving out of the formal sector and going underground. And you have no sight of what they're doing, and they're still supplying credit. So the business models and the survival of the smaller lender and the specific service that he or she supplies, especially in deeper rural areas, needs to be considered. We are not asking for special price. Let's be clear about that. We just want to compete on a fair ground, and we want to do so legally. I need to say, in fairness, ladies and gentlemen, we have seen that people load their products, for example, with Credit Life. We believe that is to make up for the shortfall because their business can't survive. And we have engaged with the NCR on this matter several times, and we have now been informed that the process to re-look the licensees is underway. I think in that re-look, we need to ensure that the matters which we've discussed here today and the way in which we propose it being done is considered, and in that process, we believe ultimately that we will ensure that consumers have choice, that they will not be locked into only some institutions, and we also understand that it's not in the interest of possibly big banks to assume the risk which comes to some of the customers which we serve. But our cost structures is massive at the moment, and we are being pressurized from many angles, and we believe that the matter is fixable. I think, Mr. Chairman, that concludes the main points I would like to make. And let me then also at this point reiterate that we are deeply engaged in the sector. We work with SARP, with CASA, with the NCR, we work with the FSB, we work with the Ombudsman offices, we work with the NDMA. We certainly are not on a mission to see if we can carve out a little special role for ourselves. We want our members to be part of the mainstream, and we do see this as part of the right for financial inclusivity. And I want to just as a final point say that in terms of the role of development finance and what needs to be achieved in terms of the Act, the microfinance of Africa is involved in that space. We have huge challenges, and I'm a little bit concerned that we have not even discussed that once in this forum. We focused on consumer lending, while out here there are thousands of people who are starving and are desperate to get to development credit. And we need to also ask that question going forward. And from our association side, we are engaging in that space, and we will work with whoever requests us to do so. I thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, security, questions? Honorable Murray, Honorable Salah.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Without having the benefit of all the feedback and the background that you've had in the past, just a something that you've mentioned is the illegal bucklings and the illegal credit providers. You've stated a problem. Obviously, we come to how can we resolve this problem? And I think that you see yourself or your members as the experts in that field who are very in depth in those communities. How do we resolve this? What is the role that you can play? Because, it is fair and it is reasonable that people on all levels must have access to credit. But it must also be there for them. So, directly the guys who are in the system. But how do we do that? So only by setting the problem, not really resolving the problem. So we have to get to situations that we can look at alternatives. Because obviously then the NCR, the DR, whatever party that does that work, that we can come up with some plan to not over regulate or further regulate, but to at least make the, you know, the opportunities reasonable and fair to everybody, be that the lenders or the borrowers. So we need to be there and you know, as a equity society in terms of them as well. So I'm really interested in that part of this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also wanted to touch on the illegal guides that Honorable Maria has touched on as well. And what I'd like to know, we need to enforce it. We need to get rid of them out of the market, because those are the guys that are really creating, I think, the big problem. But are the penalties for these people enough? And if not, what do you suggest the penalty should be to ensure that you can get rid of them once and for all out of the system? The second issue is the cost of credit. You talk about the high cost of keeping a business in operational, and therefore if one tampers too much with the cost of credit, it's going to push people out of the market. On the other hand, should we keep businesses in place that are expensive to run and the consumer cannot maintain? Should we not find alternative ways of making loans available then, maybe to the bigger players who can? We can afford, do it at a smaller amount. The question I want to know is why can one institution do it at a reasonable rate, and yet another institution does it at exorbitant and absurd rate? I mean, we looked at the one micro lender last week, charging the equivalent of 392% or something like that per annum. That's not fair on the consumer. So maybe the industry should relook at the way that they administer themselves. So I think that the point I want to make is because it is costly to run, and I mean part of the cost to run these things is high writers. But why are we having such high writers? If we've done the affordability study properly, then you shouldn't have set a high write-off. If you see a person can't afford a loan, you don't give a loan, then the chances that he can't pay you is not there because you haven't given him a loan. But why are you giving him the loan in the first place? Thank you.
Thanks very much, Commissioner. I just want to pose one question, consistent with what we've been talking about, providing credit, which is the business case. But also, I've not heard in part of our discussions, striking the balance with access to credit, except the culture of saving and adoption. I think it has been a topical issue in some years that there's a serious problem in terms of culture of saving by the South African society. It may not be the issue now, but in some instance, how do we begin to grapple with that particular aspect? Well, the reality of the situation, the culture of saving is gradually declining or perishing, and there's an over-reliance in terms of access to credit. But furthermore, if you look generally in the society, you find number of people, the stock fares, number of creativity from different people using their social capital for various purposes in this area. Maybe it's an area where we're not rushing that we can begin to explore as well. Because if you can look in terms of different studies in India, how the particular space in terms of cooperatives in the financial sector, how the mainstream people have managed to take a certain stage. I think there are a number of international lessons from our great counterparts as well. Maybe it relates its own time and its own research. There's been an issue around the, I don't know what else to say, the collaboration between employers, unions, in terms of providing credit, but also the preference on the pay scale. But in some years, whilst I was still a shop steward, there used to be a percentage where the employer is for that you will not allow an employee to take home the money, which is because it used to be regulated, so that employers are equally responsible in terms of managing, because the payslip and the payroll, there are some of the areas which are regulated, but are they properly regulated? Because if the employers to the pay office are not going to be taken accountable, we may be facing a lot of problems. That's why at times you find that number of deductions are made from the pay slips. And if employers are not complying and monitoring that particular space, we may be finding ourselves chasing a target. The issue of the education, because everybody says we must educate. But last week there was an increase in terms of reports, increase on fuel, number of analysts were beginning to say we must avoid to enter into a debt trap. But who do the education? Because education is an ongoing issue. Because the more there's an increase on the report rate, the more there's an increase on fuel and other commodities, it means that extra benefit to the consumers. So I'm not blaming anybody, but I want to ensure that on periodic, we're able to find a way of educating the consumers, including the unintended consequences of some of those particular developments, including certain measures that can be considered in terms of cushioning the interests of the consumers. I think the last issue was an issue of the social dialogue on the development of credit. Can you expand more in terms of that particular aspect? Thanks very much.
One more question.
Sorry, Chief, it's just something that I forgot. It's got to do with what I asked previously. And that is, as the association in this, what do you think is a fair cost for a short-term loan? I expect that that the cost at the micro and the loan is higher than I said. But is 395, 400% on the cost acceptable, which is happening at the moment, or is it 30%? At what level do you think is a fair cost to charge the consumer in a way that is affordable for the consumer and will keep the micro lenders?
Thank you. Let's allow you to keep up.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members. I would like to say as a kickoff that in terms of the questions that have come back to us, that actually speaks to the heart of many of the dilemmas which we are grappling with as well. discussion of the public engagement with all stakeholders around these issues outside of the strict competitive legalistic environment is missing. There are a couple of initiatives going on at the moment in the private sector to get this engagement to take place, and I think it would have so much more impetus if it also comes from this side of things, and where government is deeply involved. I say that as a preamble to much of what has been said, and I say that with great respect. In terms of the question, what do we say needs to be done and can be done with regards to, let's call it, the scopus and the machinesis? We did allude to some of it in our previous papers, but I would like to take it a little bit further. I think let us not rubbish consumer education and the importance thereof. It was the last question which was posed, and I want to deal with that right up front, that we can know about the initiatives that are going on in that space. But let me also add to say, consumer education in itself is not going to do magic. In terms of what's happening with regard to consumer education, there is a work group in which all credit providers are involved. They have also engaged with the Department of National Treasury, and in a meeting which was held yesterday, there was final sign-off between the credit providers, which includes the banks, and the Landseeker, and just a matter of interest, the Landseeker, that's the Sectorial Education Training Authority, in its mandate, looks after banks as well as the microfinance industry. It's written into the Constitution, and we work very closely with them every day of our lives. We've agreed on a content to be made available to the broader society. That content will be freely available to all credit providers, and credit providers, we will then do training to ensure that the knowledge and the skills transfer with regards to this particular matter does happen. The dilemma is, however, ladies and gentlemen, that at the point where a person comes for credit, he's not interested in your education. That's the last discussion he or she wants. And to make the education conditional to receiving credit, all it means is going to go to the guy who's not going to make it conditional. That's the wrong point to do it. So that touch point is very important. And all of what we're saying here now has been acknowledged in this work group, and there's a broad process to go out. I think that the matter is so big, and it demonstrates the need for harmonization and cooperation between government departments and regulators, industry stakeholders, and community organizations. It cannot be the single responsibility of a single sector of the fraternity. And it's a massive task, a base summary. So my first comment to Honourable Marais' question would be, consumer education is crucial. The second thing is, and I know that the regulator will not agree with me, we believe that anyone supplying credit needs to be registered. What these reporting requirements will be, and what the oversight will be, that's a debate to be held. But the fact that there are two dispensations as we speak. At the moment, if you have less than 100 loans, you don't have to register, you only have to comply. But the reality is that doesn't work in practice. It is two sets of rules. And therefore, we believe everyone should be registered. Part of the education then out there should be, if the guy can't produce the badge or number, don't do business. I think the next exercise which needs to take place is that the formal industry, together with civil society, and I would believe also with regulators, should actually set up situations whereby people who are classified today as machinists actually are being introduced into the formal environment, and that there are structures and situations created whereby people can take hands and start shooting. And to your comments, Honourable Lloyd, the real expertise of what's going on the ground lies with the machinists. We removed one layer further than they are. And they understand what's going on the ground. They understand the needs on the ground. I mean, I can tell you, some of them come visit me in my office. And so we need to make the step up. But we just don't have the guts to do this. And even within their own fraternity, there are people who are malicious, which they don't want. And more so in certain rural areas closer to Sasa Pipeworks. I honestly believe that in terms of true financial inclusivity, and I'm putting beyond credit, the question of our savings, beyond that, there is need for microfinance, which includes microcredit, micro savings, micro insurance, and those products and services could find their way to the market within a formalized structure if we are able to set up better working relationships with the guys who are truly on the ground. So that would be, to me, the strategic challenge which we have to take. At the moment, people are shouting one another. You know, we segmented. The banks are out there, and they're split in big and small banks. We are in the middle, big and the small lenders. Then there's machinistas, and there's good machinistas, and there's bad machinistas. We have this debate to divide, rather than to facilitate integration. Because, to me, financial inclusivity is more than having a vanguard, and it's more than having access to credit. It's also enjoying the other side. And let me explain to you some of the scary stuff we found there. Mention was made about savings and top cards. I happened to bump into our researcher earlier this week. They've got indications now that there are stockfels who are doing lending. They're doing that lending in the way that they see fit. When the individual defaults, he runs to the loan shops to make sure to make up shortfall because you cannot afford to be stigmatized because you're not performing as a stockfel. Which also then speaks to the question of savings. Exactly in the same way that it's expensive to do a small loan, it's very difficult to do profitable deposit taking on small packages. And therefore the return on those small packages and those small deposits are low. So the whole dilemma around dealing with the lower end of the market and dealing with people who have relatively lower resources, lower means, and getting the collective benefit out of that situation is the challenges which we need to address. And we need to become comfortable with the fact that at this stage there are two economies in South Africa, and we need to bring them together, and we need to bring them together rather faster than slower. That's why I'm in there. And then in terms of your comment about development finance, a couple of comments. More money has been lost by credit providers entering into that space than money has been made. That's the first comment. Secondly, the ability to capacitate both the lender and the organization or the person taking up that money is hugely expensive. In terms of doing it competitively when you bring in foreign capital, the expectation in terms of reward from staff is higher than in comparative countries, which makes the models fail. And finally, I also need to say that startup businesses fail. They fail badly. And credit providers just do not have the ability to take those knocks. Which then says to me, we need to engage very differently with a body like CIFA, the Small Enterprise Finance Agency, which we do engage with. My view, and that's a personal view, the nexus between development finance, enterprise lending, and the supply of housing is an opportunity which we need to capitalize on. I think that would be a more gradual transfer from consumer lending to the world of development financing, and I think if the focus is on housing, a lot of benefits can be derived there. And your chances of success and use of new technology is better, I think. Lots of stop-up businesses out here, nobody wants to touch them. And if you have to touch them, the question is, who's going to take the first risk? Because you have to provide for a massive write-off. If you don't want to provide for the write-off, you need to provide for the capacity building. We are involved in exercises to that extent. Even within SADC, we have received money from abroad and involved in those processes and going very carefully. Broadly speaking, there is a fraternity of development finance people. I think the most known one in South Africa is SEF. They do have 100,000 borrowers at this stage, the borrowers at this stage. But their story needs to be scaled and duplicated. And what is really concerning, Gary, with respect, is that in the rest of Africa, the guys are doing this successfully. They are speaking to us about how you do consumer lending, and we're trying to share with what can learn from across the SABC. I hope that answers your question, Honourable Ray. Honourable Philippe, in terms of your questions, first question dealing with penalties. If any one of my members transgress, the NCR knows exactly where to find them. They visit the office, they do an audit, they engage with the guys, they put out a compliance notice, and things may end up in the tribunal or in the constitutional court and high court as happens. It's a very different place where you can get to. The moment you're in the informal market, the whole issue of enforcement and what is a fair penalty is problematic. And the NCR must speak for themselves. To have the capacity to oversee these, I think, 50,000 people, and although I don't have my register, is an enormous task. And maybe registration is the wrong way to go, but there's a practical issue. So, you can't have a policeman for every police. You need to get to a place where society also takes responsibility. And therein lies a dilemma. The same researcher which I referred to earlier. The research is clear. If I make use of my Shunisa, he serves a need, and therefore I am not going to report him. And I will not ask questions about the crisis. I will not ask questions about the unaffordability. The less documentation there is, the better. And you know, tax is the last thing in the guy's mind at that point in time. So in dealing with this very real market, the social dialogue should be much stronger. The other side to the question that is, should people not go out of business if they're not strong enough? Clearly, we subscribe to the model of the free market. The reality is there has been interference in this market already. The moment the prices have been set, you've got interference. The moment you have interference, the dynamics will change. So we make peace with the fact that we work in a regulated environment and that these prices are determined. We don't support it, but we can make peace with that. In terms of the liquidity requirements for banks, as per Basel III, if they go right down to the market where machinists are operating, and they don't have the tools and the ability to, one, vet their customers properly, and secondly, to deliver the small parcel, the implications for the banks will be, I don't know the numbers, but there will be a different rating on the banks, and there will be issues in terms of their ability to ensure that they are liquid, and that whole scenario has a knockdown effect. So the in and unintended consequences think will be problematic. I think it will stay my time in that market. I don't think it will bring the price down. I think there's a perception that price determines default. That is not necessarily so. I have members who have been doing short-term loans for 20 years with a collection rate of 98%, because they've done their business completely. Then it also caters the market where people carry a provision of 30% plus. So I want to get back into the equation with regards to cost. Where the discussion goes wrong is when we talk in percentages. The percentage discussion is fine for me to drive a finance vehicle and live in a mortgage home, where we are comparing ourselves to the first world and what's going on across Europe and, let's say, in the middle upper class of South Africa. When we bring a loan onto the books, and the figures of this announced this morning, it very clearly shows that you have to, first of all, meet the compliance requirements. Apart from the registration, which is not a big cost, you have to have the office, you have to do the affordability, you need to go to the credit bureau, you need to engage with the payment system, and those costs are fixed regardless of the size of the loan. So, I know you understand these things, so I don't want to patronize you. For us, the real number is not a percentage. It is an actual rand value to run the business. So to your question, what is a fair price? My plea that we sit around the table, that we take a view on what does it cost to run a small business, what would be the appropriate products for the total market, not just for this segment of the market. And if we have to create additional products which makes credit affordable, a guy should not be paying the current unsecured rates on a loan of 100,000 rand. It's wrong. But if a person, and we have clients like that, on 5 days before payday comes and says, I need 500 rand till the end of the week, then the percentage creates a wrong impression. He probably pays maybe 600 rand for the 500 rand, but if you analyze that 20% over a year, it's 240%. But there's no massive problem. If you put 240% on 100,000 rand unsecured loan, then you do change. So, to your question, I respect Honorable Swanepoel. I'm not going to give you an exact number because it depends on the size of the loan. We have put it in writing and we have engaged with the NCR on this and we have made our submissions. We plead for a process of activity-based costing. And we are not saying the smallest of the smallest must survive. And we must also allow for innovation in terms of the use of technology and access to information. And the access to information is crucial. And it also includes the effective use of the payment system, which is a costly thing. It is not cheap to participate in that. The issue of savings, Honorable Boyer. I think there's a perception that you cannot borrow and save at the same time. I think that's a misperception. I think most middle class people have an annuity and they have some savings instrument, but they may also have an overdraft and credit card. I think it is about the discipline. The problem is currently savings do not return the results people want. It is just not worth your while. If you save with rent, there are the issues of bank costs, which has been under scrutiny and we did it in front of that committee as well. And to become a deposit taking institution in South Africa is a hard call. It's impossible. So in terms of saving and the returns you can expect on saving, I think we must accept that we're in the hands of the banks then. And I do believe, and we have informal examples of that, where our members actually encourage people to save with all sorts of incentives. And I do believe people do want to save. It's just not worth their while, or there's not enough encouragement for that. With regards to the role between the employer and the employee, I want to start by saying the following. One is, there are great schemes where employers, employees, unions are involved together around financial services products. It includes housing, it includes credit life, it includes credit. There are great schemes like that. And it's bona fide, and it's working, and it's serving anybody. But there are others which are questionable. Your comment is around take-home pay. In particular, that is what the affordability process wants to do, that a person should have a cushion. The problem is, the call on the guy's disposable income is not limited to the workplace. So you can have a fantastic scheme, you can educate until you believe you've covered every possible base. If the individual walks out there, nothing stops him from taking credit and spending his money in whichever way he wishes. And I think we also just need to be careful that we do not decide on behalf of other people what they need. We need to give them options. And I also would think that in many cases, employers would not be able and capacitated, especially those smaller and medium-sized guys, to play in the financial services business. It's not equal business. The bigger the business is, probably the more they would be able to do so. Honourable Chair, I think I've dealt with all the questions. I hope I haven't overstepped my time, but it's been quite a list.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I allowed you some more time because I think the issues are raised are quite important. And I think you need to
can I just, Chairperson, if I can comment and maybe this is more directed to the DTI. I think first of all, just when you want consumers to make the choice, maybe that's submitted into your, in terms of the response to your remarks. If there's an incentive to a consumer that is big enough that justifies him to make a decision, don't expect the consumer to be the policeman. Forget about it. That's an illusion. It will never happen. If there's an incentive for the consumer to do that, most certainly then you can rely on the consumer. If not, forget about it and waste your time and money. Secondly, to the DTI, and that's more maybe a general thing that one pick up. You see that in traders, informal traders, Sabines, whatever the case may be, there are very little consequences for non-compliance. You know that, I mean, if there's not a threat to me, really, by number applying or doing it illegally or below the line, why would I stop? I would just go on. But somehow the DTI would have to look further than just the compliance side. But it's a general thing. So that's in our society. So it's a societal thing that must be addressed. And that deals with more businesses than just finance lenders. That's just a comment, and I think that is the detail I will have to look further. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Let me not ask the DTI to comment now, but allow them to comment on that as well when that item comes for them to respond to all the other issues. Thank you very much. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. We appreciate the opportunity and thank you for giving us space to do so in another last step. Thank you.
The next input from Gas Company Industry, Mr. Ferdinand.
Thank you.
allow the flow. I see the time is just about 10 to 11. I would like us to break in between the people to take tea.
Maybe this week?
Yes. That's what I propose we should do.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, we're proposing to put an input. The issues which the DCI was requested to attend and to respond and expand on are quite substantial. I'll try and go through them as quickly as possible in order to not unnecessarily waste time. And I think it would be more prudent to thereafter deal with questions from honourable members to try and limit those. Chair, I might just ask for assistance in the delay system. I think the... Okay. The main issues which the DCI was referred to had answered was the first one, consolidation loans. Now, consolidation loans are dealt with in terms of the National Credit Act, Central Section 88 financing. What this basically means is that at the time of a person applying for debt review, they're entitled to consolidate the debt. And ultimately, what that means is that the debts get paid off, and that's a one loan. The other type of consolidation loan, which is available, is those types which are prior to an application for debt review, and consumers are normally in financial distress. Now, in both these categories, it's important that no funds in any manner whatsoever should be advanced to the consumer themselves in a personal capacity. The point of a consolidation loan is so look, these are your debts. Let's pay them off, you pay 1 month back. So you don't have four people you have to pay, it's easier, simpler. The second important aspect to consider is that the funds provided in terms of consolidation loan must be paid directly to the consumer's debtors. This is to ensure that settlement figures are received, that if letters are received, and that consumers won't utilize the funds for other purposes. It provides the clarity. Once you've got this consolidation loan, your other creditors are out the picture. They're not going to be following you for money. Interest rates have been determined that you might have obtained a settlement which is favorable. The next thing to be considered is that consolidation loans should be registered with credit bureaus. I know that you see a need to be saying less information on credit bureaus, but it's important. And the reason why it's important is because if consolidation loans aren't registered, the last four system of rolling loans. So you can have one consolidation loan and that's X. You pay some of your creditors off, you can take that money, get more loans, and you can apply for another consolidation loan. In terms of the Act, Section 88 speaks to it, and says that the consumer subsection 4. If a credit provider enters into credit agreements other than a consolidation agreement to contemplate in this section with a consumer who has applied for a debt rearrangement, and that rearrangement still subsists, all apart from the credit agreement may be prepared to be letters, whether or not the circumstance set out in section 8 applies. So, what do we have? If you have a situation where a consumer applies for a consolidation loan, and the credit provider gives more credit, and it happens. The case study which is attached, which I'll show you relating to this, what ultimately happens is the credit provider will add on to it and provide a emergency expense fund. So now you have another 600 grand added on each month that you can utilize. An annual monthly no payment plan. So for 2 months, pre-credit we get an extra 10,000 rand. That in itself is in direct contravention of what the Act allows you to do. And all of the credit is written. The reason what you should do is have your proper consolidation loan, pay the credit provider, and no further credit, because the
right, but in that scenario, you have to pay up that consolidation loan before the credit provider is entitled to give you more credit. And the second part in 38, subsection 5, is that if a consumer applies for entered into credit agreement contrary to this section, the provisions of this part will never apply to that agreement. Now this part, when it talks about it, is part D of the Act, which deals with enforcement and debt review. If it doesn't apply, does is it still reckless credit or isn't it reckless credit? Because it takes two to tango. You need a credit provider, you need a consumer. If one enters into it, it's illegal. If the other one enters into it, illegal, the other part of the Act doesn't apply. So there's no point in saying that you've given your reckless credit. The other thing is with credit bureaus. We say we'll ensure that other credit providers are, one, aware of the fact that there's a consolidation loan. Two, are clearly aware that they're not allowed to advance more credit to that consumer. And three, clarify the scope for reckless. Because there can be no debate. A consumer would not enter into a situation where it's going to be applied for more loans and needed with a credit provider. They would know that they can't. They would know they're not allowed to, it's a mere few reasons. This is pretty good on the same page, so it's easier to follow.
Get done, those calculations change. So not one
20 years, it's sometimes 2 months, then it's going to be a different time 6 months, then it's going to be a different time 8 months. So there are certain credits that get paid off, the money gets applied to other debts. So it's a complicated process. It's not saying pay 100 grand for 10 years and everything's fine. The complaint obviously also that money is not distributed properly to credit providers in terms of either proposals or court orders. What does this result in? Ultimately, it results in a query, the non-payment for the debt counter by the credit provider. The credit provider can terminate the credit agreement from the debt extraction process and start enforcement proceedings, or can consider the consumer to have breached a court order and immediately proceed with enforcement procedures. So what would debt counters have to do in this situation? They would have to go to the PDA and ask for records. So they would have to show to the credit provider that you have been paid or everything's fine. If this isn't provided to debt counters, there's a very strong possibility that credit providers will get frustrated and terminate the process. And the consequences of that, particularly for consumers, is very high. Because they would now have to defend legal actions. There's content which is eroding the debt review structure. And what we ultimately need is a payment distribution system that keeps the accounts more transparent, regulated, and effective. I can't submission that the solution already exists. We say that the payment distribution companies, referred to as switches, are already in existence. They're regulated in terms of the National Payment System Act, with oversight by the South African Reserve Bank. They're highly automated systems for making payments and provide a cheap and accurate service. So the advantages of self-evident. They've been in existence for a substantial period of time. To be a cheaper cost for consumers, which means that consumers, instead of paying a payment distribution agency, do not do the work properly. They can pay less to somebody to actually do it properly, avoid legal costs, and make sure that the industry has some sense of confidence in the process. It also obviously allows consumers to rehabilitate earlier, there's more money for the debts. The cost savings, which we say has been gained due to the fine-tuned systems that these switches have. And for the past 10 years, those which are registered, it's been monitored by South African Reserve Bank. There's no question that indicates in 4.8.4 of the Grey Man, trying to implement a new system, seeing whether or not it works, and understand that for a consumer facing financial distress or under debt review, every year, every 6 months, is a long period of time. It takes them out of the market. We say, why run the risk of having individuals registered to TDA, of having companies registered to do this, to try and reinvent the wheel when the wheel's there? It can be automatic. It can be DK registered, that's right. You've got the systems, you've got the tools, you've got the regulation. The requirements are obviously first that we audited the strict record keeping and transparency. And what we also submitted is that there would be no additional cost to the NCR in respect to the regulations done by the South African Reserve Bank. So what we propose in terms of the amendment is that natural persons and US persons should not be registered. It allows for a possible distinction between and interrelation between various other banks in the credit industry, but rather that switches should be registered in the capacities with NCR. So you could then go to the NCR and you could say, I'm registered in the National Payment Distribution System. I want to be registered at the PDA. And if the NCR has it, I said, good, you can now be registered. You listed as one of the people that can be signed, and ultimately the regulation is taken care of by the Reserve Bank. Doesn't have to be anything more. You just have to show a certificate every year that you registered in terms of the payment distribution agency system to ensure that you continue registration. The difficulty discussed earlier was a conflict between possible various sectors. We believe that the conflict exists in this, in that the Reserve Bank, South African Reserve Bank Act makes provision for the South African Reserve Bank to be liable to organize and prevent and structure, register, regulate, and distribution agencies. So that we're not careful that what ultimately is going to happen is going to be a conflict between the two. You're going to have regulator infringing upon the rights and the duties and obligations specifically reserved for the Reserve Bank. But they're going to be doing the same thing. So that's unnecessary. In fact, we think that the Reserve Bank is the right party who should be doing that. So the price structure is obviously monitored and enforced by the Reserve Bank. And then we also said that the existing CDA can apply to the rest of the switches. So impossible for them. They have to meet a criteria so that the consumer, the debt counter, the credit provider, so is appointed as a switch, but the same distribution agency is going to be doing their job properly. They can register and then apply for accreditation. The other aspect that we were asked to comment on is the role of the court. So there has been numerous challenges in the interpretation of the National Credit Act in various courts. And what ultimately happens in the local court, the magistrate's court, is that no decisions are made until the higher court makes a decision. Because you could have a situation where decisions are made in the lower courts, but it's overturned in the higher court, and ultimately all those decisions are wrong. Particularly when the National Credit Regulator, Reserve Bank and others, or directors, what happened in the lower magistrate's court is that nothing. Definitely applications weren't heard, because there was uncertainty as to what applies and what doesn't. So for the space of almost a year while that case was running, debt review applications for magistrates were stopped. So that is, unfortunately, that causes the delay, causes the result of loss of confidence. You have a consumer, he's applied, he's filled out his affidavit, he's lodged his application, now he has to wait. And it costs money. Each time there's a postponement, the High Court decision might be expected on the 30th of March, so you postpone to the 4th of April. Come the 4th of April, the decision isn't there, so you have to postpone again. So it ultimately increases the cost of litigation. The other difficult experience is that there's a uniformity in magistrates' courts with regards to the debt review procedure. Certain magistrates require more information, others less. Certain require the consumers to be present, others don't. Certain require affidavits and papers, others don't. So when an application is made in a particular court, a magistrate, you have a situation where all the information or the requirements of that particular court are different from other courts, which means that it causes more delay. There has to be a postponement again, that additional information can be provided. The 5.3 is probably the most important, and what we say there is that to say that the courts don't have the necessary capacity to allow a debt review application to go through in 60 days. And the importance of that is because of the evidence of Section 816, which allows the credit provider to turn that. You're effectively putting the cart before the horse in terms of this section, because it's impossible to a large extent to get that 60-day period, particularly if it's opposed, and ultimately a termination is going to result. It's simple maths. So just dealing with that Section 86 then, it allows for various challenges related to and allows for the credit provider to terminate a credit agreement in view, so that ultimately, the Supreme Court of Appeal decided this authority in the decision of Pollock versus First Bank. What they ultimately said to the court said the following. Credit provider may be terminated after 60 days having lapsed, provided that the consumer was in default, and the court passes the next one, and that the credit provider participates in good faith. So there's a few legs approach to termination. The first one is that the consumer had to be in default of the original credit agreement, and the second is that the credit provider would have to have participation in good faith. What the court ultimately said is you're allowed to do that because the consumer has recourse. The court said, look, in terms of 8611, you're entitled to apply to have that credit agreement be interpreted, either in the High Court or the Magistrates Court where the matter is being heard. Now, if a consumer is in default, but if there are financial problems that apply to their scheme, the credit provider may not make use of Section 86 to terminate it. credit provider cannot turn that. If that makes sense. So it allows for the proper resolution. It's more difficult for somebody who was in default. But now the credit provider can automatically terminate. He doesn't have the two legs to stand on anymore. One, the default, and good faith. So, at 6.5, we say that the proposed amendment is good. It will clarify the situation. Protect the consumer should also be covered. We'll limit the scale of litigation which can arise and ultimately provide the uncertainty. We would have able to propose that the 6-day period be amended to 9 days in terms of 80%. It allows an additional 30 days to ensure that where there is opposition, for example, that the court has an additional time to deal with the capacity. Without the automatic countdown, which occurs on the time of the client to get reviewed for 6 days since termination list, it allows sufficient time to try and get the matter in court. And we would propose that it goes even one step further. 6.8, we would propose that an additional subsection be put into section 86.10, which allows the magistrate during the debt review application to consider an extended time period of 90 days. The magistrates are on the ground, they know what's happening. Sometimes buildings are being built, sometimes magistrates are sick, sometimes courts are going sick. In proper circumstances, the magistrates would be entitled to say, look, we're going to have to extend that period because we just don't have a court available. We're going to have to extend that period because we aren't in the capacity to actually get it. That can be an application launched by the debt counter, by the consumer, to say, for the next period of time, allowing them for such time before they can terminate. Particularly in circumstances in litigation, what often occurs is that the closing affidavits, for example, need to be filed by a particular day. Now, for some reason, they can't be filed because of uncertainties or travel. It could actually now depend. It's the fault of the credit provider. You can say, well, you don't get that advantage for a 90-day time period running against you. You allow for the proper magistrate to make a judicial decision and say, look, let's stop that because this isn't the consumer's fault. So let's allow an opportunity. Why do you say it's important? Because credit provider debate here, concern that electrical applications can be used by consumers to avoid obligations by simply lodging an application. The first thing is because it has no merit. The magistrate's court rules make a vision for the manner in which applications are dealt with. And it will always be open for credit providers to apply. In terms of the rules, simply that a debt will be application set out. So even if you say magistrate you can extend this to, or you say 90 days, if after the first period of time there's no movement from the consumer, the applicant, the credit provider can immediately step in and say, look, I want to terminate. I want not terminate the agreement as such, but I want the application dismissed. What that is you go back to the situation of not having an application and the credit provider can dismiss. So it makes it incumbent upon the consumer to advance the matter, but the magistrate's court rules already allow credit provider feels that a consumer can authority to take the steps to enforce compliance with the rules. So it would be also important to remember as stated before that the consumer's application has implications for the consumer themselves, the credit readiness, the rehabilitation, the stigma that is attached to it. The inability to terminate is another situation where we said that it was correctly interpreted by colleagues. That if the consumer is not in default, you shouldn't be allowed to terminate at all. The proposal that has seems to be new amendment which we support. And we say that ultimately the greater period of time adds to fairness for the conclusion of a debt review application is to the advantage of all parties. Why we say that is that say for example you have a credit agreement. 60 days passes in the current legislation. You wish in default at the time of the client. The credit provider decides you're going to terminate. And so there's no way to include that back cheaply in the measure.
left from my court. He said, look, I want to enforce my rights. He said, you went there, we are terminated. Now the consumers and the FDA is forced to pay an additional price and have to base that following case. Say, look, I wasn't a default. And that's the truth. They're going to have to get bank statements. Surely wasn't a default. He's going to have to alternatively say that the credit provider didn't act in good faith and they were busy negotiating. The third level of what he's top of the unfortunate consumer is that he also has to explain that there's a chance of success in the magistracy. So what you look at is a substantive application. You can get opposed by the credit provider. There's been opposing papers, the consumer can find more papers, and all of these things unfortunately cost money. So our submission is the longer that you allow the possibility for a resolution within the debt review restructuring process in the magistrate's court, you're going to avoid the additional unnecessary costs incurred by consumers, incurred by credit providers, and ultimately having an impact on the capacity of schools. To us, it makes sense to allow for that additional period of time. The section 129 letters, which is notice of default, which a credit provider may bring to the consumer, dealt with in terms of section 129.1. This has been dealt with in terms of the, as mentioned earlier, Nedbank versus the National Credit Regulator. It means effectively that the consumer, if he receives a 129 letter, cannot apply for debt review in terms of that particular credit agreement. He cannot ever apply for in terms of his other agreements. And the court still does retain the ultimate power in terms of section 8.5 to consider whether or not the credit agreement is credit. So not a complete bar on it, but that particular credit agreement cannot form part of a debt review restructure. As the proposed amendments say that we draw to the default and the disputes can possibly be tended to various people to look at. We said that it's necessary to amend the section to expand on the information that needs to be contained in that 129 letter. Because if you look what it says at the moment in terms of 129, it says, major legal to the notice in writing, propose that the consumer refer the credit agreement to you, and if the various parties you, and suggest that we must come to a plan to pay it, and in the event of a dispute, refer to the National Credit Regulator's report. But what it doesn't say is that we say should be in all of these letters. We said that in these letters, the original date of the credit agreement and the capital amount of each applicable letter should be included. We should give that information in that letter. The current capital amount and the current interest, the details of the consumer court number and national credit regulator, to actually put that information in there. The contact details, the email is best. The amount of the current arrears, which is an important aspect, and the portion of the outstanding amount that relates to capital, interest, other finance and additional charges. Particularly credit loss charges, those type of things. So where the credit agreement relates to mortgage property, the consumer's attention should also furthermore be drawn to the possible consequences. The sender's first letter, the mortgage property that should be brought to the attention that judgment could be taken against them and they could ultimately evict it from the idea that at least it will alert consumers more to the importance of it. If you're in default and their credit agreement and you get the little envelope in the post, most of the times you throw them down because you already know you're in trouble. But if you happen to open one of those or you leave one of those, you can crack it more seriously. The first thing. The second point, that the information relating to the capital, the arrears, and the interest proposed will assist any consumer and any individual assisting them in determining the maximum amount which they would be liable for and therefore assist in negotiation. You have the capital amount at the starting time, you see what interest was charged over here, and you'd be able to say whether or not, look, we need to come to an arrangement. What's our current interest rate? What's our arrears? How can we actually pay the arrears? How can we solve your current problem? The interest rate and finance charges, you said, should be disclosed so that the person can do things to do it. If the loan was taken out 10 years ago, for small amounts of money, but interest charges that exceeded the loan, you see what the difference is. Because if they had said the capital amount for loans is 3,000 and it was going to be at an interest rate of 7%, and you're 10 years down the line, and the now capital amount is 13,000, there's a problem. is you can never go over the steps. So automatically you'd be able to identify where the inducement rule in terms of the provisions of the National Trust Act set in. Without that, you have to go to the process. I suggest this information is important to anybody helping you consumer in such a situation. Then we say that obviously the contact details of the relevant bodies is also an important thing. So the power of the consumer. Because it makes the necessary inquiries to the automatic address review. They can then be referred to debt counters registered with the NCR. The NCR is a query within the area in which the consumer lives. An open and transparent system of referral by the NCR and credit providers is essential to ensure that there's no conflict of interest, certainty, and that consumers are provided with the assistance. It's easier if you have the phone number of somebody than going to try and find the phone number, make inquiry. If it's on a piece of paper, you know immediately it's going. And you might have the option of a few different people to spend on the National Credit Regulator. I'm trying further to submit that we should allow for a consumer who is in default of the original agreement to bring their real payments up to date. And should be able to enter into a suitable arrangement for the credit provider to do that within a 20-day period. Remember, the credit provider would have to wait 20 days before it can institute action. So what it should provide is it should allow the consumer pays up to be in a position where it can continue. Because in those circumstances, the default would trigger the outstanding balance. So let's say you have a bond. You've short-paid 1 month. That entire to stand the entire capital amount. So the lender bank, you listen, please come and sort out our loan. Make an attempt. It could be 400, 500,000 back to the consumer, it makes no sense. But to allow the bracket to say, look, the outstanding amount is 7 pounds. Come to us within 20 days and see if we can resolve this. Now you've got the opportunity where the consumer can actually go and say, look, it's been a tough month, or I'll pay you the same amount next month that I meant to send to my son, but I can break that 7,000 up in 3 months. It's a sore fees month, it was a hospital expenses, whatever the catch might be. The other possibility is that without the provision, as indicated above, i.e. that the consumer has the opportunity within 20 days to bring their arrears up to that, and therefore not being default for the agreements anymore, would automatically allow credit providers to start the enforcement procedure. You're given away the possibility of the parties being negotiating. And I think the importance in finding the balance that the Act seeks to address is the question of negotiation. 7.11, we said, without the ability to pay off arrears, which comes up in an arrangement, and so we refer that to debt review, the bargaining position of the credit providers are much stronger than the consumer. The credit provider can insist upon repayment terms which are impossible. So if you owe 400,000 now, the bonds fall back, about 10,000 a month, it's going to be impossible. There won't be a resolution tax. If it's 7,000, the credit provider says, look, one half now, half next month, you might come to a solution. The credit provider can insist on those retentions, and the consumer won't be able to use them. The credit provider knows they can proceed with the enforcement. We submit without the proper amendments, the proposed amendment, which currently is in the draft proposed amendment to the bill, i.e. the safety net, which is the situation where a credit provider may determine to include a credit agreement into debt review is pointless. If at the point you can terminate, it's not a question of may. What you do is you balance that one, and you give the same amount to the consumer to say, if I make up my difference. If the bond payment is a small amount, and you get your letter and you say, look, you need to make up the arrears, come talk to us. You might be able to come to an arrangement which is suitable to make up the arrears without going into detail. With regards to reasons as to why I say that there's been great loss in the industry, but the following reasons. The praise of the matters are referred to court. I've touched on that already. Different courts, different ways, colonizations, the way that the Act is being interpreted, and sections are being challenged. We said conflicting information is to the credit providers, to what remedies are available to consumers. The amendment to the section 129 later will make that better. So that credit providers should also be carefully monitored to ensure that there isn't, as mentioned in submissions last week, a perceived link between certain entity and preferred people to go speak to sort the data. It should be a case of you can go to their counter number and then into the not you should go to this one because we partnered with them, you've got an advantage, or you'll get a better deal with them. Consumer obviously effective, so the better be waiting a year while you're waiting for the better be all that take away that sense of finality. So the NCR regarding the PDF and role of mediation association. The clarity, the forcefulness of making the act work needs to come from the NCR. They need to step up, they need to make sure that everybody knows the ground rules. For the PDA's relation to payments, and obviously frustration and termination. The terminations we've already discussed will have enormous legal consequences. In a certain situation, in our client's experience, that the debtor of your partner could agree to a restructuring order, but the legal department doesn't know that. The consumer now believes they have a proper debt review in place, and then the sheriff comes and knocks on the door, because they're now going to come take your house. So those problems also cause uncertainty within the minds of consumers. As indicated before, the 69th period, the period of waiting, it could be terminated without the opportunity of actually trying to address proper restructuring proposal. The consolidation agreements, so these are also a concern. Now, consumers approach in debt review, so they assume that look, you can come out of debt review or consolidate the loan. The undermining of debt counter by the NCR, failing to deal with complaints. It's important to feel that it's a support structure. From the debt counter's point of view, from the credit provider's point of view, from the consumer's point of view, that the complaint is large. And somebody goes to the problem and it's properly investigated. At 8.1.8, so that there's no enforcement or lack of proper enforcement. We say that the National Credit Act at the moment actually makes the vision how complaints should be dealt with by NCR. It's dealt with thoroughly. It says if the complaint is large, they may do certain things, investigate, refer to public. The Department of the National Prosecution, they can refer to a tribunal. If those things start to happen, complaints would see the legitimacy. Stakeholders in the industry would see the legitimacy that there's so much required. See an investigation, an openness, a transparent report, and a dedication to correct it. That done properly, we submit would change a lot of the difficulties which are currently being experienced. Because it only has to happen once or twice, and it's not going to continue happening. That particular trade, which is crept into the industry, will fall out. The other aspect is that, despite evidence being provided, the consumers have been paying, credit providers still terminate agreements. An unfair, unbiased system. But now, it places the consumer at an extreme disadvantage to actually litigate. So they don't have the money to use. The non-adherence of credit provider support orders, particularly the seizing of charges, get orders, debit orders that set on accounts and other charges which are added. So, when a consumer goes into debt review, what should automatically happen is that credit provider should stop his account. Stop trying to take dead orders. But if a credit provider takes a dead order against an account that is not any money, he gets to pay for it, the consumer. The credit provider doesn't pay for it. Your bank charges you then because you didn't have money in your account to pay. So a 50 rand, the minimum charge, for four different credit providers, the consumer is getting 200 rand taken away from it, which is just increasing one debt. So those things should stop immediately. The credit life insurance is another issue. We'll deal with it in more detail below. And the other part, obviously banking utilizing that system anymore. Or if you are utilizing a particular bank account, so you're saving. Remember, all your banking are basically a PDF, a large portion of it. So they should reduce accounts which are in debt from you, credit cards, loan, a home loan, stop the monthly charges on that. There's a reason for it. Why are you paying the monthly charges? And when you talk about the cost of credit, the important thing is that the account has been reviewed, it's been restructured, and agreements are coming to an amount, and it's being repaired. There's no reason to resubmit at the additional burden, because what's going to happen at the end of the day, and it happens in practice, is that a consumer is under debt for 5 years. Started off with a loan of 10,000 rand, and has made an arrangement to pay that loan. After 5 years' time, the consumer has been religiously paying its loan. Comes to the end of the period of time and says, look, credit provider, give me a paid up letter. Tell me I paid you, so that I can go to my discount and get a certificate that I need. That's not fair. After 5 years of 57 and a month, in respect to bank charges, guess what? It's not paid up letter. Although you've agreed on an initial amount, over the course of years, you're going to still come to a situation where the credit provider says, no, but you still owe me another 2,000 rand. I can't be a paid up letter. Now, imagine for the consumer who's been looking forward to his rehabilitation in 5 years' time. Now comes to the point of saying, no, but you still owe 2,000 rand on this one, and you owe 3,000 rand on this one, and you haven't paid your credit license. So it's a serious concern, and it should be enforced properly. Because it makes the certainty, and it allows for quicker rehabilitation. So that's the consumer to feel that the process works and allows you to come proper active credit means. The other delays, of course, in the industry and the system, the lack of information relating to cooperation from credit providers, the certificates of balance that's discussed, to be something that they have to provide in the beginning, that's the amount you owe, how much, and that should be the same amount. The details of the arrears and interest, the credit agreement documents. Not all of this is readily available from credit providers. And it makes it more difficult to determine in different procedures what is a record credit. These should be fixed things. To be consumer A doesn't have to be right to credit providers, and they should immediately bombard you with all of the information. Here's the bank account, here's the credit agreement, here's our affordability assessment. This is what we looked at when we did it, here's our interest rate. Because it's allowed for proper restructuring, not in a vacuum. You know, the consumer saying, I think I owe 5,000. The credit provider says, no, you owe 12. No, he's right. How does the person sitting, who's trying to negotiate the repayment, you know what's right? So that this can be resolved quite simply by forcing the credit provider to keep this information and provide it at the time of interest. So obviously that the variable nature of litigation, sometimes that needs to be substantial. People can query them. This also causes a delay. Further affidavit might be required for sustainment, and we go once again beyond that 60-day period. Court process, the capacity we discussed. We also say that in certain instances, you almost, the way that the act currently is almost going to result in termination. And it's going to result in more costs, more frustration, and more delays. So we should maybe look at a longer window of sensible negotiation. The ultimate part of that, and what we stressed last time, is that we need a speedy resolution process. For disputes between the stakeholders, so that the dispute relating to debt will be proceedings are not delayed. Now, taking an example that's accounted by my client on numerous occasions, the credit provider terminates the debt after 60 days. Court doesn't hear it, there might be delays. Otherwise, that cost, and I said, look, you're in default at the time of applying for the interview. Credit provider institutes action to enforce agreement using the High Court. And it's important to note, the smaller credit provider, which are owed personal loans, credit cards, etc., don't receive terminate. They are generally happy to renegotiate. They're happy to say, look, let's talk about this. Let's lower our interest rate. How much can you pay? They negotiate. The secured ones, for example, a mortgage fund or make a vehicle are the ones that terminate. And they immediately rush it to the high school. Now, the two things that you have there, you have a residence and you have a mode of transport to earn an income. So it's the most important thing for a person who wants to buy for their experience, is the most likely to be taken away. If we look further, we said that the credit provider would institute the action. Now the consumer would have to defend, as indicated to you earlier. We'd have to say that he was not in default, the credit provider did not participate in good faith, and that it would be just an equitable thing to go back because he can successfully rearrange it. It's quite an onerous task for a consumer who doesn't have all the bank account statements. You can't say that your credit is wrong in the first place. You can't even suggest it might have been reckless credit. That's why the information that comes in the beginning is very important. Because now you're empowering the consumer to have a credit agreement terminated from debt review, to actually have the ability to successfully, quickly and easily, those courses they have. This is a lie. Look at, this is why they have done this something. This is why they've acted in good faith. And this is why I have a good chance. So the delays the finalization of the debt review process, because without that information, this all has to be gathered from third-party sources by the consumer and consumer. The debt counterparts to make inquiries, like the credit provider, take time. And because of the two major things that the consumer would want to protect, now your residence and a motor vehicle, it stops the entire debt review process. So now even if the person with a credit card agreement or a personal loan has agreed to the return to repayment, the consumer can't take that order because his car and his house are excluded. Now you can't have it back in there without first having a high court application determining that he's entitled to take it back. If he takes that order without the car and the vehicle, he can't get the 8611 order in a high court because what that provides is that the court can refer that to the debt review. If he's got the order, his debt review is finished. So it causes the magistrate's court debt review application to be postponed every time to await an outcome of a high court thing relating to a car or an office. And all that does is add difficulties to the capacity. So we said that a proper resolution process, which provides for the halting of proceedings and suspending further legal steps, is a key issue to be determined for validation. Defaults and good faith can be resolved, and we believe that the tribunal can do that on appeal on the NCR if necessary. Without the consumer credit provider having to incur additional costs linked to court. So, for example, in our scenario with our consumer, the credit provider terminates. He institutes a resolution process, a letter of complaint, in order to get something. Proceedings get suspended. Credit provider cannot enforce. The debt review cannot go through. There's no prejudice to either party so far. And they go through a quick process of resolution with the National Credit Regulator. Because if you have to look at the question of default, it's a factual determination. It's a question of looking at a particular bank account at a particular time. So when you go into default, and if that's that where you in a real way. So that's probably my quick factual. The next scenario is obviously the question of good faith. Was the credit provider acting in good faith? That can also be determined by the National Credit Regulator. We submit that with the process of transparency relating to the audits, that what will effectively happen is that a guideline for good faith will over time be developed. So listen, if the debt counsel gives you a proposal, you must answer. You can't answer that I want 90% of the person's income. That's not good faith. But the fact that these things can be determined relatively quickly by a resolution process will ensure that it doesn't continue to happen. The PDA, as we've already discussed, the code of enforcement.
The input being made is
them to go through these institutions and add whatever they need to add to their response tomorrow. Because that's when they are supposed to do. If that's to be accepted, unless there are urgent issues that the city outline to respond to today, we will allow them. But I suggest a fuller discussion, fuller response. The benefit of the DI, I have had a look at these documents. I'm sure some of the documents are new. They're coming this morning, and they haven't had time to see them. I say that also considering the fact that we might just line up around our time. I'm not sure what other commitments people have today, and that's my one. Otherwise, we could stretch it to talk, but I don't mind that. But I'm not sure whether all of us will be able to do it. Let's rather agree to have this everlasting process. So we will still take questions of clarity, but we won't go to the other side. We'll definitely agree. Can I just allow a 5 minutes breather? If you come back, don't be outside so that you can continue. Thank you.
I'm sorry to get any questions.
So what are you doing?
Huh? Do you have a copy of the presentation that you made?
The one today or the recent one? I have a document about today's stuff, and I also have a full presentation. I think this stuff needs to be read in conjunction with the medical supply you with all across.
If you can email it,
okay.
By that box at PMG.
Okay, I'll do that.
Thank you.
Because we do engage with those. Okay, we will come from Leone probably. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Leave that it's advisable, furthermore, to
liquor compliance with the codes to the registration of the industry players, implementation of the penalty of fine, particular reporting on the citizens and transparency, to provide the certainty which the industry requires. We suggest in 10.5 the Minister of May, with provisions as proposed, amended to make the codes part of the regulations, to then set up proposed task teams or inquiries with the relevant stakeholders to submit public comments as to what should be in those codes, in order to establish something that each of the industry players are happy with. The Minister should, however, we sort of retain the power to introduce the codes with interferments after the consultation. So we submit that the Minister should have that power. The codes of the industry should be put in place in reasonable consideration of communications, of their restructuring arrangements, concessions which credit provider prepared to give should be recorded in the codes, and it would also be advisable to set up the requirements for information to be provided by their counselors and consumers so that negotiations and restructuring can take place. Our client believes that establishment of proper codes of conduct will also lead to an effective harmonization of the current practice and limit the number of banks to request court. Proper codes can also provide for mediation process, which I find is the best form by their counselors and ensure that such mediation process is subject to such codes and limits the choice to consumers. It's cheaper than going to the courts. It would be particularly useful in the context of the section 129 debt receivability discussed, and in the circumstance where debt review is not applicable or desirable. Mediation could then be proceeded with to try and resolve the issues. The other aspect which I find raises in relation to mediation and services is that newer companies offer these, they've got high charges. They're charged in respect of the initial application for mediation, legal costs, attorneys get negotiated with credit providers on behalf of consumers, and often a percentage of the negotiated payment is taken by these companies. So if you pay 500 rand, 50 rand go 3 months to the mediated company. Consumers waiving rights. 2.9.3, concessions regarding preferred mediators by credit providers not granted to other causes conflict, confusion within the industry. And as part of the mediation process, what often happens is that consumers have to consent to judgments, the default on the repayments, the total tax amount, consent to change jurisdiction, and emolument of tax rebates. So effectively, the mediation process takes away the rights of consumers if done in this manner. I'm not saying that they all do it like that, but there's a lot of them out there. Our clients admit that without proper regulation, consumers can be placed in a worse financial position, and there also exists a conflict of interest potential between mediation associations, credit providers, and third parties, particularly if concessions are granted to them whereas not to others. Our clients admit that debt counselors have this as part of their function in terms of the National Credit Act already, so that mediators, they can inform this. Provided there's some payment arrangements in place, the experience has been that credit providers are happy to agree to it. If they advise for difficulties such as financial emergencies, generally credit providers are not the bad boys everybody makes them out to be, and they might actually, with the information, be able to consider a proper mediation process. The important thing to note is that a mediation process is a short-term process, which should only be for 6 months. Anything longer than that, and you're in the realm of debt review. A 6 month period is to allow for that particular difficulty where debt review is not useful. The short-term financial cash flow, somebody's lost their job, there's been an emergency, but for 6 months you get a credit provider instead of need a little bit of help for the next 6 months. Our client's experience has been a credit provider will need to assist for the period, knowing what's happening, knowing if the person's coming to you, change their personal circumstances and their financial circumstances. Our client admits that it's beneficial for consumers for debt counselors to perform these functions due to their knowledge and expertise in the industry. They know they have the contacts, they know they speak to credit providers on a regular basis and are able to perform the function. Guidelines for mediation can also form part of the code, which the minister can regulate or prescribe. And this will set out the basic workings where people know what area they're dealing with. Also, if after the 6 month period you find that the mediation process is no longer sustainable, the debt counselors are already in a position to immediately help the person to enter his debt review proceedings. The guidelines relating to the resolution code, as far as that's concerned, the important submissions there is that it's time-based, so that matters are resolved quickly, without this amount of prejudice to the interested players. The suspension of the operation in terms of the national space allows the parties to properly resolve it without more litigation. The final effect that we discussed in the mediation of the case, the enforcement by themselves, make sure that industry stakeholders know what is happening. One of the most important aspects raised in the rest of our client is the affordability assessment. I can't believe that the current regulations and requirements for credit providers in respect of the format documentation and information is wholly inadequate to prevent an increase in the granting of reckless credit. I can't submit that in particular face a situation where credit providers don't have access to the information which might be reviewed from credit bureaus. The affordable assessment information should be prescribed by the minister. I feel very strongly about that, and that should be enforced by the National Credit Regulator. It should be more in depth. There should be in the consumer's own choice of language. Often you find people signing agreements which they don't really know the meaning of. Must be explained in clear, simple terms as provided for them to the Consumer Protection Act. To be verified by third-party sources, and they're quite important. For example, bank accounts, municipal accounts, and the personal information of consumers. The credit provider should keep copies of all that supporting documentation. Because at the time when the consumer information is not verified at the process of the affordability assessment, it opens the door for abuse, not only by credit providers, but also by the consumers. And there are obviously risks associated with it. In particular, it is important to note that the gross book debt to unsecured credit in the 120 platter range is more than doubled from 2011 to the second quarter. This means that credit providers participating in this have become more exposed to risk. The time period in which they can repay is greater, and consequently more consumers have participated in this. Without proper detailed affordability assessments, consumers are placed in a position to manipulate the truthfulness. And in particular, we have reference to the case study, which is attached to the documentation presented. From the case study, the following will become apparent: that the affordability assessment conducted by that particular credit provider allows for certain information to be recorded as payments. Bank accounts are provided to that particular credit provider. And on a simple perusal of the bank account, you see that the affordability assessment is completely inadequate. The information contained in the bank accounts is not reflected in the affordability assessment. And this is where the problem steps in the first place. The other issue that can obviously arise is that credit providers can provide the credit and thereafter claim that the consumers were untruthful in providing it. This will eliminate the proper affordability assessment prescribed by the minister, will eliminate this as a possibility. But then says, this is the information I had, I verified it was proper. If thereafter the consumer lied about something, that's something completely different. But if you look at the bank account, you can see how much you pay on a car, how much do you spend on electricity, how much do you actually spend at pick and pay. These aspects can then be properly incorporated. A credit provider is asking you how much you spend on your car. Now, if you're in a position where you want to look, you need to know that you have to pay the lowest possible amount to show that you can afford to repay this. If you verify that information on a third party basis, this is crucial for credit providers to do. That equation comes out of it. We also have a situation of unethical credit providers with no regulatory framework. I think those are the ones we're discussing really at the lower end, with the lack of financial knowledge of consumers, which are problems. and the best consumers that we've done. So this would lead to a possibility that credit is provided in certain terms for a student form. The collection method, we submit ultimately in order to make it as quickly as possible, that debt collection methods employed by credit providers should allow for the situation in terms of the Act where the people appointed by credit providers are held accountable in terms of the Act, deal within the same guidelines, the same codes, and furthermore that where debt is sold or ceded, the same should apply to those third parties. The next important aspect is the reckless credit. Improving activities within this scenario. And without a proper system, so that it's difficult to find out what there was actual reckless credit. So we're back to the affordability assessment, and that this will help determine whether or not there's such an issue of reckless credit linked with the credit bureau information available. That a proper affordability assessment and ensuring guidelines and codes for reckless credit will prevent consumers taking of loans, situations that are desperate, believe they can solve their underlying problems, afforded loans by entities without properly conducting assessments, taking unsecured loans in circumstances where the other alternatives are not properly accounted for, such as possible mediation or debt review. The other aspect which we were required to study was the question of the possibility of criminal offences. Our client's admission that without proper regulation codes, there's a real possibility of occurring. The consolidation loans, as indicated to you before, is something which is contrary to the provisions of the Act. In the general offence section found in Section 157 of the Act reads as follows. An offence to hinder, oppose, obstruct, or unduly influence any person who is exercising the power of performing a duty delegated, conferred, or imposed on that person by this Act. This means that failing to provide information to get out is a hindrance. The credit providers who failed to do that is perceived to be an offence in terms of that section. The most common examples are no certificates failing to negotiate in good faith, failing to provide information, failing to deal with matters. The PDAs possibly also, because they hinder the entire process at the moment. We furthermore submit a personal, granting of personal loans or entering into additional credit agreements where consumers are under debt review, falls within that consolidation thing and criminal things. Then have the conflicting information which might be produced. The credit providers pointing consumers to certain referred assistance is an offence. It hinders the function of the other functions to debt review or debt count is meant to have. There's also erasing phone calls. There's an example which is attached, SFS. You'll notice there's almost on a daily basis a telephone call to a consumer is in debt review by a credit provider. Now, what happens in these scenarios is that it's imparted to the consumer that the debt review process doesn't work, the agreement is terminated from debt review, they're going to lose their house. All of these things are part of hindrance because it's affecting the consumer's view of the debt review process. The other aspects which we need to consider obviously the involvement between certain credit providers and associations out there, like previously mentioned, the link between them causes confusion and it does cause hindrance to the protection of the Act, which means to apply to consumers. The major last aspect to deal with is the credit life charges and interest. And often credit providers include in their products credit life charges when providing credit. Basically a form of insurance taken out in respect of credit agreements, but not properly explained to consumers. Interest is added onto them, which is illegal. It's not part of the capital loan. But at the end of the month, the statement runs and says what's outstanding and adds interest. So if a consumer doesn't pay, it's interest added and they track interest. So desperately, the consumers are used in such a situation, they've done anything to obtain these loans. And the credit charges are substantial and often make the repayments possibly larger. Out of mission, that in respect of has to be a present partial debt review, that all of those get cancelled, credit line, and that the consumer can take out credit line in respect of all of its consumers at a cheaper rate. The difficulty is that because of the additional enforcement, the additional charges rate to use loans, and the cost of it, is not purely related to the cost of the loan, related to having the industry work and keep the voter closer. I think those are the main questions then, Chair. In particular, I'd like to enforce the aspect of the code for credit providers, debt counselors, mediation and resolution would go a long way to solving the problem which are currently experienced.
Thank you. Can you raise your questions and clarities? I'm sorry that I'm giving you quite a short time, but I think we appreciate the details in which that has been given. Honourable Silao, let's see the hands, Honourable Waila, Honourable Silao. In that order.
So the money is not so much of a question, but it's true. It's a comment to say that there are many similarities in the presentation of the presentation that was made earlier. But secondly, many matters that are listed here are matters that have been raised in various presentations in relation to the amendment bill. I would agree with you much, Professor, that we need to give the department an opportunity to do a better study of the particular matter and India reported to us from when we have a platform. They should also try to touch on this particular issue that I raised here. Most of the issues here, if not all the issues, are uncommon. What I want to say are common to us. Or are not
uncommon to us.
Thank you very much. I would say also really appreciate the well packaged presentation. Some of the concrete proposals. I just want to get a few clarity, especially around the issue of coordination, the alignment. Because to me, there remains a gap, because there are different role players. We've got the credit providers in the space, for consumers, for regulators, national credit regulator, you've got the Department of Justice in that space, but also you've got in that space the national treasurer, multiplicity of stakeholders, yes, trade unions. And the reality of the situation is that some of these multi-stakeholders are supposed to be mutually complementing each other. But to what extent are they conflict in terms of perspectives, and for a number of reasons can disadvantage the consumers? If there are examples or case studies, we would like to understand you. Because you can regulate, but what becomes important, are we effective enough in terms of ensuring that this piece of legislation, all of the stakeholders who are involved in the arena. But the second area, it linked to that one, the effectiveness and efficiency in terms of dealing with some of these particular issues. But one of the major things is that it links with some of the players, PD, has your perspective and the view in terms of the PDA and the mediators. But one of the most important aspects which we have to take into consideration, even if they disappear and there's a recourse, but it is important that that recourse ensure that the money that has been collected from the consumers who are in the serious financial crisis, whatever the recovery measures, because companies you can deregister that particular person, but the bottom line is that in the value chain, the consumer is bearing the brunt of an unethical behavior from an institution or an organization that was supposed to be helping him or her in terms of moving out of the crisis. I think the last one is in relation to the court proceedings, the delay, the capacity, the efficiency. What are the concrete proposals? Because to us as CTI, we know that we know our mandate, but also how to ensure that some of the fundamental gaps that have been identified in other departments, be it trade and industry, be it national treasury, be it the Department of Justice, because we'd like some of those areas to come up and drop. Because it will not help us in terms of fixing some of these things through the National Credit Act, and we allow the loopholes that exist in other system departments now to strike that particular balance so that there's also coherence in terms of getting some of these multifaceted issues. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable Bahidi has just covered a lot of what I wanted to say to ask, but you know, it's actually quite a sad day that we have to look at regulating in practice what should be normal ethical behavior by the institution. Because, I mean, providing the basic information for people to do the job that they don't think. So, what you said, a lot of logic, and I just find it sad that one has to go and start regulating what people should do. Credit providers should be as keen at resolving the problems when they arise as they are in granting the credit in the first place. So that's just a comment that Honourable Wee has covered the issue about the coordination between the various pieces of legislation. And then just to say that a lot of this, I suppose, will have to come by the regulation in the amendment bill itself. And lastly, I don't know, I've just got case 33 on this document and on the document next to me, so I don't have the benefit of the other case studies. The one that I specifically wanted to look at, case 38, is not yet the benefit that we've got it here where the enemy is provided. Thank you very much.
Right. Let me allow the
CTI
to seek charities on some aspects that have been raised here. Sort of that enables them to make sense of their responsibility as well.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks, Honourable Members, for the opportunity. Just so that we can make clarity to it, so that when we go back for our responses on this aspect, then we're able to understand it. In regard to the area around PDAs and the switches, we just want to find out if the presenters do have the actual figures of how much is being charged by the switches, exactly what is being charged by the PDAs, just so that we can be put in context if we think they're cheaper, and then when we go back and we consider the information, then we consider it in context. And then the second aspect was, I think, covered slightly by Honorable Maide, I think, just in terms of because in the remarks that the presenters made in their last presentation as well, it's some gaps around FATs in the consumer tribunal. So we'd like to find out what are the areas and which areas do you think that need to be set up so that we can, you know, find solutions to some of the challenges that they are raising in that space, but we are not able to pick up exactly what are the areas. So I think it will be very useful for us.
Thank you. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you. First and probably the best part is the Honourable Minister Wahidi's considerations. The first one I've answered was whether the consolidation fall into place with the Department of Justice, National Treasury and Trade and Industry, and how we stop the loophole which might find themselves within that. I think the key to this is a regulation code with resolution process within the National Credit Act. This would allow ultimately to a large extent to exclude the involvement of, for example, the Department of Justice. If the issues can get resolved without having to go to courts, it solves the problem. We have delays due to lack of capacity, high courts deciding matters, and so forth. A quick resolution prevents the additional burden which would be placed on the judiciary. With regards to National Treasury, Trade and Industry, but that the codes again provide a solution, because the understanding that I have that is to allow people, consumers, to become credit active and responsible members in terms of the credit industry. The code, properly regulated, provides for that to happen a lot quicker than going through the process of litigation, longer rehabilitation. The relation in terms of switch compared to PDA, that's money, quicker rehabilitation, quicker credit providers. Proper consolidation loans means that consumers can resolve their financial difficulties quicker, effectively without incurring more debt and without paying it. In the cycle where it just continues. The other aspect to consider in relation to that is that when one considers the National Treasury, the ultimate idea is to have a sustainable credit market which protects and balances the rights of credit providers and consumers. So but that our proper code in place, putting certain restrictions on credit providers in particular, is an imbalance. And call it that imbalance, you're never going to find the middle ground that's required to say that I'm a credit provider, I'm going to be responsible. And because of my position of bargaining power, I'm going to be more responsible than the consumer who doesn't have the financial knowledge that I have. He's in the worst bargaining position and at greater risk. Proper code and proper resolution process will balance that out very quickly without the necessity of having to delay the rehabilitation or put additional burden on the judiciary. The suggestion that the regulations, as put up in the presentation, the power be given to the minister to put forward those regulations for credit providers, for consumers, for mediators, for switchers, whoever he wants to, and that consultation process can take place with the relevant stakeholders, with the minister ultimately still having the power to determine those things. To give everybody the opportunity to have transparency, everybody can come and say, look, that's impossible, our systems can't allow that. We need more time for this type of thing, or we'd have to change this. And everybody can actually come forward and say the practices which we address the affordability assessments, I think, is very important. I think that's something that cuts down to the bottom line. With that is probably verified by third parties. You come down to the point of saying, have you done your job properly as a credit provider? Were you ethical? Did you investigate this properly before granting credit? We think that takes it down to a level where the regulation would ensure the ethical behavior that's required. In relation to the questions from the DTI, the PDA switches and the costs, associated with them. PDAs work in a fixed system. The cost structure set out within the current regulations is what I understand. The guidelines are east, and it provides for certain amounts to be taken in respect of search amounts. In our previous presentation, which included the DTI hands, we showed the difference in the potential cost saving for consumer with 10 credit agreements as a 90 rand cost saving per month. If the switch did it, the consumer would save 90 rand. If the PDA did it, there would be a cost associated with it, which would be 90 rand more, which means 90 rand less credit card, 90 rand less towards rehabilitation. Unfortunately, Honourable Swanepoel is correct that the difficulty should be that it should be regulated. But I think that the credit industry is of such an importance to a variety of people that they are not an economy effectively, that without proper regulation, reliance on the goodwill or behavior of the participants within that is not necessarily sufficient. And when I say that, I say it in as much as for the credit providers, but also for the consumers, for the debt counters, for the people involved in it. Because, as previously indicated, there's an adversarial nature. A credit provider wants something, a consumer wants something. And if you can't regulate that fairly between the two of them, there's always going to be a disparity. And I hope that successfully answers the question.
Thank you very much. I hope that's done. Thank you for now. Did you have your...
Sorry, I just realized that the other questions on the DTI relate to the tribunal and the possible gaps and where the thought that things might to breathe there. I think the starting point again is the codes, proper regulation. All the industry players know what the rules and obligations are. It's going to be easier for the NCR to enforce that and trying to interpret legislation or set out this is what you need to do. The NCR should be the first calling port that indicated in our proposal with a guide to be dealt with within a particular time limit in a non-confrontational manner to try and resolve it with transparency and openness. And from there, ultimately, we would suggest that the tribunal would have the right to get those matters on appeal. Anybody is unhappy about the decision of the NCR, it could be upgraded to the tribunal, with ultimately the tribunal making the decision to bind the people lower down. So they would set the precedent. We think that in terms of the National Credit Regulator, obviously there has been improvements in terms of investigation, starting support, complaint procedure. The improvement, it is anticipation, will be dramatic in the beginning, but will very quickly water down. As soon as the transparency comes, as soon as people start seeing these are the guidelines, this is what I'm allowed to do, this is what I can't do, these are the regulations, you're going to find not as many complaints what the National Credit Regulator is currently having. Flowing from that, I think you'll find that there won't be as many referrals in respect of the regulations to the tribunal, because they're ultimately going to be watered down. The other aspect which has come to attention of my client is the importance for the tribunal to have capacity to grant consent orders a little bit quicker. Consent orders are often sent off, and when I speak about a consent order, it's obviously where 100% consent is received from all credit providers. Everybody agrees on a term of repayment proposal, and instead of having to go through the court process, the tribunal has the power to make those orders. When sent to the tribunal, there's a lengthy delay between the time of submitting the order and getting it back, if at all. So what it does, unfortunately, again, puts the entire process into uncertainty. There's no direct order which prevents things from happening, and there's obviously all the same difficulties. So we've said that those are the two aspects which would need to be upgraded. And the, as previously stated, would be that the regulation will provide for access to reckless lending, assisted by affordability assessments, which can also be dealt with by the regulator, by the tribunal, in terms of appeals if necessary, but it would set the guidelines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. Members, thank you very much. DTI, thank you for your presence, and NCI. three quarters present here. Thank you very much. And Venetia. Thank you so much. We'll meet tomorrow. We need more back here at 9 o'clock. Thank you very much.
Thank you.